Welcome to Rough Drafts, How God Writes His Love in Our Stories, a podcast that explores the faith journeys of our friends and neighbors in Burns, Tennessee. Everyone has a story to tell, and in this podcast, we'll hear powerful and inspiring stories of how God works in the ordinary lives of people like you and me. Our stories are unfinished and perfectly imperfect. They are just rough drafts, a glimpse of what is to come because God is still at work, writing plot twists, introducing new characters, and bringing good even from the most challenging circumstances. Join us as we see what God is up to in our stories. Here's your host, Matthew Hyatt.
Friends, today you get to hear from one of my favorites. Oh, how do we introduce this one? I think I figured out how cool she was somewhere near Houston, Texas, on a DRT trip. Those are two pretty good clues when she and her husband were doing push-ups on top of each other. I think I have a picture of this, but I think I might go missing if I ever show it. She is a talented musician. She is a great grammar proofer. She can fix my bulletin articles. She's a whole lot of things, but she's just one of my favorites. Today, you get Susan Bradford.
Hi.
Hello.
I had forgotten that.
I have that picture.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Can I do that as the episode art for this?
I might want to see it first.
Are you sure?
Yeah, probably not.
It's pretty amazing. Well, Susan, welcome.
Thank you.
So people have already heard from Frank. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the custom in your relationship, that sentence. People have already heard from
Frank.
Pretty
much is. Yep.
Frank is a lot.
Yep.
But behind a lot of people who are a lot, there's usually somebody who is, oh, what's the word here? Just awesome, but quieter.
Yeah.
And you are awesome and quieter.
Well, thank you.
What's your story?
Whoa. I've been trying to decide about this story because I feel like, well, number one, it's a long story, but I was born of not so poor white child in Union City, Tennessee.
Okay, Northwest Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, up near Real Foot Lake. I was born there. My parents were living in Henderson, but I was born there because my father was preaching in Troy. And there was a doctor who was an elder at that church, and he became my mom's OB doctor, which is weird. But, yeah, he was.
Did they, like, trade chickens?
I'm not sure. I agreed not to preach about him, or I don't know what it was. But, so I was born in Union City. My brother Ralph always called me a Yankee because I was born in Union City. But anyway, we know. My mom and dad were on the faculty, both of them on the faculty at Fried-Hardeman. And so that is where I grew up.
Yeah.
That's the environment I grew up in.
Okay, what's that like? Because, you know, Fried-Hardeman is, we always called it the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chester County is not a big county. I don't know what the population is, but Henderson is not a big town. It's
right.
And Fried-Hardeman, to me, felt like about 75% of the population of Henderson. I don't know if that's anywhere near right. Maybe it was 2%, but we thought we were that important. So what's it like growing up in the shadow of the Mecca of the Churches of Christ?
Well, you know, you came from Nashville, so you were used to a city, so the size probably was a bigger shock to you.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I grew up. It's my home. It's my people. It was our social life. We went to music lessons at Free. We went to ball games at Free. We went to concerts and recitals at Free. We went to lectureship. You know, it was very much our social life.
For being a swampy cotton patch in West Tennessee, the university would have provided a pretty cool amount of culture and experience.
Absolutely.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. More so than in most small towns in Tennessee. So I was very blessed for that, those experiences, having lived, you know, where I lived.
So Dad's a preacher.
Dad was actually a located minister the first 20 years of his and my mom's marriage. Mostly, well, the first few years all over, in Texas at the end, several years. And then he got the call from Fried Hardeman to see if he wanted to come and teach. He was a social sciences major. He was in the first graduating, well, he went to Fried for 3 years and then went to Pepperdine. And he was in the first graduating class from Pepperdine.
Really?
Yeah. That's where he got his bachelor's degree. And then he went to Washington State and got his master's there while he preached, too, while he was doing that. And then when they, he actually taught a year at Fried while somebody was off getting their master's degree the first year they were married, and then he went and did located work for 19 or 20 years.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So what was that like for you?
Well, I wasn't in that.
This is all before you.
Right.
Did.
That was before I was born.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So mother and dad were married in 40, and my brother Tom was born in 45, so they'd already lived like four different places by that time.
Yeah.
And then they'd had some miscarriages before and after that, and 8 years after Tom was born, they adopted my brother Ralph, who lives with us and is a member at Burns, and then moved to Henderson a year later, and then 3 years later, I arrived.
Ta-da.
Ta-da.
And the angels rejoice.
Yes, yes. I have often told people that I am a faculty brat and a preacher's kid, the only girl and the youngest. So that explains me.
You're kind of hopeless to start with, weren't you?
If people can stand to be around me at all, it's a miracle from God.
Whatever. Okay. So, you know, you grow up in that experience. Life is kind of bathed with the school and the church and all of these opportunities.
Yeah.
What was high school like for you?
Oh, high school was fine because I had my group. I had my people. We were active in band and scouts and chorus and youth group. And we had, you know, out of the five of us that ran around together, four of us went to church together. And so, you know, we had our people.
Yeah.
We had our groups, and we were, band was our life at that time.
Yeah.
We had a very involved band director who later on I found out that he had relationships with some of the students. So I feel very fortunate that I didn't know him that well. But
you can't say it like that. That's something I would say. You know? Friends, this is why I like Susan so much.
Yeah, well, sorry. Not many filters, but yeah. But it was very much our life. We were, you know, section leaders and officers and involved. It was good. And the church, youth groups. My dad preached on Sundays after he started teaching. He wasn't a full-time minister, but like many of the male faculty at Fried, they have preaching jobs.
Where was he at?
Well, let's see. He was in Middle Tennessee, like Chestnut Grove was a place. It's somewhere in Hickman County, I think, or maybe Perry County. The ones that I remember were Bethel Springs. Mm-hmm. He preached for 2 years at Bethel Springs, and then he went back to Troy for 2 years, and then Hornbeek for 3 years after that. And that's next to Troy.
Gotcha.
Same area.
You know, Northwest Tennessee has some of the best town names. You know,
Skull Bones.
Frog Jump.
Yep.
There's another good one up there somewhere. I can't remember. There's a sign in Skull Bone with the sign that points to all the different towns that you can get to from there. So you're, you know, high school, you're all involved in church. You go to Fried Hardeman. And?
Well, an important thing that I should mention before this is a major traumatic event would be that when I was in the right before my eighth grade year, my dad was diagnosed with an acute leukemia.
Okay.
And that changed life. At first, he was only, they thought it was just a bleeding ulcer. And I remember when he came home from the hospital and there were signs on the door, you know, don't ring the doorbell, you know, he needs his rest, blah, blah, blah. And we thought that was a life change.
Yeah.
But then when it didn't get any better, and they did, this doctor that actually was the one that delivered me, did further testing and found that he had leukemia. So, aggressive treatment, but he only lived about 9 months. After the diagnosis. It was probably about a year before it started, looking back on things, but 9 months after the diagnosis.
So how old were you when he passed?
13.
You were 13.
I was in my eighth grade year.
So that's a moment in life.
Yeah.
What effect did that have?
You know, it's been 50 years. If I, you know, if I don't seem emotional about it, it's because it was a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I felt like I remember questioning God. I remember crying in front of the mirror and saying, why? He's such a good man. Why would this happen to him? He helped so many people. He was such a good man. You know, why would this happen after his death? And but I never was angry about it.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it, but it was just one more thing to just, you take the next step, you do the next thing that you need to do. And that came from my mom.
Yeah.
That came from how my mom dealt with things.
To press forward, we did the next right thing.
Right. And she was brokenhearted.
Yeah.
They did everything. They shared an office. They worked together in all kinds of things. And I think I was more devastated for her loss.
Yeah.
Because I just remember her tears. Mm. I remember her crying every time we came to church. But anyway, that was major.
Easy.
Mom and I were very close, probably, you know, even closer. After that, I feel like I probably got away with a lot because I think my dad was a whole lot more suspicious of me or would have been than my mom was. But that was a deal.
Okay. Yeah. That would have been a hard deal.
Yeah.
But life goes on. You do the Fred Hardiman thing.
Right.
What's next?
My degree study couldn't be finished at Fried Hardeman because I'm a medical laboratory technologist, and so I had to do a year somewhere else. So I did 3 years at Fried and then planned to transfer to the medical units, UT medical units at in Memphis. That's what they were called then. And so that was what my plan was, and I was working for that, and I was accepted. I mean, I don't mean that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But I didn't date a lot in high school, and I didn't date a lot in college. And I did have a couple of long-term relationships, but I didn't date around very much. But at the beginning of my last year at Fried, which is my junior year, a guy that I had been going to church with, I mean, we went to the same church. We went to Refuge. He asked me out. I don't remember if I was riding with him to church, you know, how we give each other rides all the time to the country churches. But anyway, he asked me out and, he pursued me. It surprised me, because he was a big man on campus. He was, very well known in theater. He did a lot of, and was very good.
Yeah.
But everybody knew who he was. And the fact that he was paying attention to me was weird.
Felt good.
And surprising, but absolutely it felt good. And, you know, because I hadn't had that.
Yeah.
The people that I had dated, I thought, these are not really people I particularly want to date. It's just because they asked me out.
Yeah.
And that's sad, but that's the plight of women at that time, at any rate.
Yeah, you kind of stuck with who asks you whether you like them or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a whole conversation, a whole podcast we could probably do about that.
Yep.
So did things develop?
Things did develop. We were spending, you know, all of our time together, as you can do when you're in a residential campus like that. And around Thanksgiving, he asked me to marry him.
Okay.
And a week later, I answered him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That should have been a clue.
Yeah, if it takes a week to make the decision, it might not be a great decision. Can I say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can say that.
So this is one of those places that I'm just going to kind of break the wall of the podcast. I don't know if that's a thing in podcasts or not. I know pieces of this story, and I don't know what pieces you're about to tell me. And, you know, whenever you're vulnerable about your life story, what's tricky is you have to think about how to tell that story, both for yourself and for your kids and all of those things. So I just say that to our listeners. I want you to appreciate whatever it is Susan shares, because these things are tough. We had an episode, one of our early ones, where someone spoke so incredibly carefully and kindly about a really crappy situation. And I was so grateful that she was willing to share what she did, because I think sometimes these are the stories that make life better for people who are still in the middle. You know, we're sitting here today. Your story's nowhere near over, but the story you're about to tell me kind of is.
It's a lifetime ago.
Yeah. So I'm just going to kind of sit back and say, tell us what you want to tell us, Susan.
We had a lot of the same interests. We had a lot of things that we were different on. But one of the big things was our faith and our desire to do mission work. And so we made plans while we were there, you know, just kind of explored where we might want to go, who we might want to go with. But that was not really need to go in any detail about that, but that was part of our preparation. And he is a good person. I can probably tell this story with more grace now than I could have 20 years ago, you know, because distance. Time helps, but also because I understand so much more about what made him who he was and who he is. He grew up in a home with, his father was an alcoholic, manic depressive, ex Church of Christ preacher.
Okay. That's a mix.
And the last thing that he wanted to be was that.
Yeah.
But he pretty much turned into that.
Gotcha.
And, you know, did he make choices? Absolutely. He made choices. Was he limited by genetics, upbringing, culture, understanding and accepting of mental illnesses? Yes.
Yes, he is.
You know, in this day and time, would we have been able to make a go of it and been a lot healthier? Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly. That's a big regret right there. Okay. You know, I wish we'd had those resources. But we didn't. We didn't understand. We didn't have those resources. I knew what his something of what his family had been like, but it really meant nothing to me. I was just too naive to understand how that would impact our relationship.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that things were ever really smooth. We even went through a period just before we got married, like 3 months before we got married, where he said, maybe we should just wait. Maybe we should, you know, just back off, give ourselves some time, and get married next year. And this is a cautionary tale to anybody that may be going through this. I said, no, everything's planning. Everything's planned. The invitations are ordered. You know, all of this stuff is worked out. It'll be fine. But that was naivety.
Yeah.
And, you know, just wishful thinking and thinking we love God, so everything's going to be okay.
Ooh. You know, that's a line that kind of is subconscious for a lot of people. We love God, everything's going to be okay. Well, there's a lot of times that line is not true.
Yeah. Yeah. So we did get married, and I finished my first year at my last year of college in Memphis. We lived in Memphis, and then he already had a job lined up in Virginia. So we lived in near Richmond, a town called Hopewell, where he was the assistant minister and youth minister there. So we were there for 3 years, had a baby. My son Clifton was born there. And then we had formed a team and made plans to go to Argentina. So Argentina was our mission point. And we had had plans to go and stay for 5 years after doing some graduate work, but we were asked to come down as apprentices with another team that was down there. So that moved up our timeline. We did that. But while we were in Argentina, my husband went through a clinical depression, full-blown depression. And it was not a good situation for a lot of reasons. The work, the Falklands War happened. Mm. So the whole, everything that the team had been successful in doing in the 3 years before that just went down the tubes. The economy went down the tubes. And, you know, it just wasn't a good situation. So at the end of 2 years, we came home. And we did not go back like the other couple did. The other couple went back and, you know, spent their time there.
Yeah.
But that didn't work out for us. So then we went to Miami. We were in Miami for 3 years. And things fell apart for us. He had a what people call a nervous breakdown, stress overload, whatever you want to call it. And at that point, he got out of ministry. And we moved back to Henderson temporarily to figure out what we were going to do, and then ended up, we just stayed there.
Okay.
So that's, Henderson is basically where I raised my kids.
Gotcha.
We had one child born in Virginia, one in Argentina, and one in Miami. So we kept the South thing going there.
There's some diversity. I guess he didn't want to get too familiar with any one hospital.
Yeah. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
So moving back to Henderson, career change, life change, that's going to be weird.
Yeah, and we were living with my mother, too. So
oh, okay, throw that in there.
And it seems like when we moved in with her, my brother Ralph and his now ex-wife were also living in that house. So it was a zoo.
Wow.
And to complicate things farther, my ex had started drinking a year before we left Miami and continued to drink for another couple of years until he got suicidal, and we reached out and got some help, and he got into AA and was pretty much sober for about 8 years.
Okay. 8 years is kind of a remarkable time.
Yeah, it is.
You said earlier this is a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
Because since I have known you, you have been married to not this guy,
mm-hmm.
to another complete weirdo.
Yeah.
To Frank.
A great weirdo.
Oh, he's such a weirdo. We love Frank. I know your kids.
Mm-hmm.
I know your brother Tom just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I know Ralph.
Mm-hmm.
What makes this another lifetime?
Well... just life-wise, you know, I was raising my children.
Yeah.
We were negotiating all the how to get along with a spouse when you have money issues and children issues and sex issues and all the things that make it hard to stay married, plus mental illness, alcoholism, and living in a culture where you don't talk about any of that. And I kind of tried to break the mold on that.
Yeah.
There was a book that came out, I think Mike Cope wrote it, Dropping Your Guard, something like that. But it was basically about taking the masks away. Mm. And we need to not be wearing our masks if we want to have true relationships with people in the church.
And it's such an attractive thing. Masks feel comfortable and safe, and you can't really see me and I can't really see you. Masks are easy. Mm-hmm. They're attractive.
They're also toxic and deadly.
Why?
Because you can't get any help.
Yes.
If you don't let somebody know that you're having a problem.
I saw this thing the other day. It said the problem with drowning is most people who are drowning don't look like they're drowning. You know, in the movies when they're drowning, mm-hmm. they're flailing and they're screaming and they're yelling, I'm drowning. But in real life, they're just bobbing kind of beneath the surface, just barely, and they sort of look like they're just, it's not.
Having fun in the water.
Yeah. And so nobody does anything.
Right.
And I think an issue that we face in church is there are drowning people here every Sunday. And I want to say we don't know what to look for, but the cynical side of me says we don't want to because, well, I've never had this experience literally. But if you try to rescue somebody who's drowning, they start pulling you down too because mm-hmm. they're so scared. And the truth is when you work with people, you know, your ex was going through some stuff, mm-hmm. but he wasn't the only one going through stuff. You were going through stuff. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what to do. You know, we barely know how to live our own lives, much less deal with this.
Yeah.
Somebody asked me the other day, why do people call you when they're going through a crisis? You don't have any training about this. You're absolutely right. The reason they call me is they don't know who else to call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we don't, you know, we think we don't have any answers, and we may not have any answers, but we have experience and we have empathy. And it sometimes all you need to do is just listen. But that's been a soapbox for me.
Yeah. Well, preach on.
That I have to be able to be transparent, somewhat transparent.
Yeah.
You know, I can't air all my laundry out in front of everybody. Not everybody's trustworthy.
No. Yeah, yeah.
Not everybody, there's not a reason for people to know.
Well, and if I have a friend who has cancer, I don't usually complain to them about my hangnail because right. they don't need that most of the time. Now, if we're super close friends, I probably still will because yep. it's important for
it's somebody. It's important to you.
Yeah. And it's important sometimes to not just be the recipient of gifts, but also just because you're going through a hard time doesn't mean you can't help someone else too. Mm-hmm. I love that about the AA communities, how significant in the model of the 12 steps it is that we are helping other people. Mm-hmm. One of the best things to do to maintain sobriety is sponsor another person. Mm-hmm. Now you have triple the motivation to work on your sobriety because you're not just working on yours, you're working on... Anyhow, I'm rambling.
Yeah. Well, and I was very, very blessed in that I had friends. I would say that the... I didn't get a lot of help from just generally the church.
Yeah.
But I had friends. And, you know, it was a different time. And not everybody knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And so I can't blame people.
Right.
I might be able to blame some of the people that did know what was going on. And
but not at large.
Yes. Not just wholesale blaming people, but I have had two very, very special friends that I would be remiss if I didn't mention.
Talk
and
about them.
They also will kill me, but not really.
Well, they live far enough away, it'll take them a while to get
here. They do, yeah. When I was four, My friend Kathy moved to Henderson. Her dad also taught at Fried Hardeman, and Kathy Hufford, Elvis and Emily Hufford, were her parents. And God put us together, and we have been friends since we were four. We have lived on opposite continents. We've lived, not close at all, and we've lived within 20 miles.
Yeah.
And right now it's about 40 miles, but it's wonderful.
Yeah.
We have cried together and screamed together and vacationed together, camped out together in tornado weather, all kinds of things like that. But
it's not camping unless you've done it in a thunderstorm.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're trying out backpacking tents.
Oh, good. Good. It's a good way to learn.
Yeah. But Kathy has been my best friend. And we don't agree on everything. We are not totally alike, but we've shared so many experiences that we just understand each other. And I hope that I've helped her as much as she's helped me.
Yeah.
And, our husbands, our current husbands, have been friends longer than, not longer than Kathy and I've been friends, but they've been friends. They knew each other at camp, too.
Yeah.
And so, in a twist of fate, we're all camp kids and gotten together in our later years. And then God blessed me with another friend. When I was going through the worst part of my my marriage and my struggles with being a single parent, and that was my friend Gerald, who moved to Henderson, I can't think right now, early 90s. And we just kind of, our kids were the same ages, and so we kind of circled around, being in the same places, and then something just brought us together, and we realized that we had a lot in common, and that's been another wonderful support there, to be able to have somebody else that you can be absolutely, totally honest with and know it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Even through the stupid stuff.
I remember a story you told one time about when your husband left and they circled the house.
Yeah, that actually was two other people.
Oh, was there?
But yes, just because those two people were people that actually lived in Henderson.
Gotcha.
And that was before Gerald and I were good friends. Yeah, he just kind of announced that he was moving out. My mind will not let me remember where the kids were. I don't know. I just can't even imagine where they were, why they were not here at this time. But because it was in January. It wasn't like summer camp time or anything.
Yeah.
But he did. And so there's a Saturday morning, and he said, I have somebody coming over, or something. I don't remember now. I've already rented an apartment in Jackson, and I'm going to move some things out. So I'm going to get some things together, and I'm going to move into my apartment today. And I was just in shock. I mean, there were things that led up to that that doesn't really matter, that don't really matter. We don't have to talk about them. But I got off to be able to call one of my friends to tell her what was going on. And she called the other one, who actually lived closer to me, and they circled the block until they saw his van was gone. And when his van was not there anymore, they pulled in the driveway to be there with me.
That's a picture of friendship, isn't it?
It is. It is. And that they were blessings.
You look back at the stories you told me, a marriage that was hard, a life that was hard, frankly, because in the jobs that you were in, there's not a lot of continuity. Raising kids is not easy on a good day. Attempting mission work in a developing nation that has major internal issues. Moving, I would rather die than move.
Me too.
So I can die literally in the house, like in the middle of the living room, just so it's somebody else's problem. Actually, I want to die while preaching. I think it maximizes my chances of not being forgotten for a while and increases the amount of trauma I'll cause. All of these things are hard stories. Yeah. How'd you become you?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm not really sure what you're asking, but
maybe I'm not either.
Just the base that I had in God, the belief that I had that God loves me, and that even though things are hard, that I just got to keep trying and keep believing and just trying to do the next right thing. And that I don't think I ever thought, I mean, when you lose your dad at 13, you know, it pretty much slaps you in the face that things are not always going to be good just because you do good things and you go to church all the time.
Yeah. It breaks that line.
It breaks that. Yeah.
Which is nice, but yeah. Not. Yeah.
Kind of hard. And, you know, I saw the example of my mom. She continued to teach, run our rental business, be very involved in civic clubs. She and my dad were really involved in Civitan. She was one of the first woman members of the Civitan Club. She was much more willing to be a planner and leader than I am. I'm much more of a follower, but I'll do it if I have to.
It's funny because I think of you as a planner and a leader.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I'll do it if I have to.
Somebody should organize Frank.
I guess there are just a lot of things that I don't feel like I have the skill set for. I mean, I can do some of it, but it's not my cup of tea to plan a shower. It's not my cup of tea to plan parties. I'm going to my younger granddaughter's kindergarten graduation tonight, and it had occurred to me on the way over here that I don't have a card, I don't have a gift, I don't have anything. I'm just showing up, so I'm hoping that's enough. I'm driving 2 hours.
Each way.
That's
worth something.
So that is worth something.
A hug, maybe?
Absolutely.
One of those, you know.
But I don't know, Matthew, I'm just keeping on, you know, and I've been blessed. I've been blessed with good family. I've been blessed with, you know, supportive friends. Churches that love me, and boy, we could get into a whole another hour if I started talking about how much we love our Burns family.
Yeah, bunch of weirdos.
Bunch of weirdos. We fit right in. But I did the single mom thing for 10 years. And truth be told, I kind of was a single mom even before we divorced.
Yeah.
Just that's the way things were functioning or not functioning. I worked mostly at night or really weird hours in the hospital in Jackson. Very grateful for that job. It was a good paying job with great benefits. Yeah. Terrible hours, but...
For ministry, that's huge.
Yeah.
You know, I know the way that insurance is today... I'd be hosed if it weren't for Leslie working for Austin Peay. Mm-hmm. Burns takes as good a care of me as they know how, but trying to get insurance,
you know, terrible.
Oh, it's awful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Her ability to get insurance and have a retirement,
mm-hmm. huge.
You know, if they didn't pay her, other than that, her job would still be worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they do pay her too, yeah. So that's kind of nice. You know.
Buys you the barbecue.
That's right. I love me some barbecue, you know. I don't have to sell meth all the time anymore.
Yeah, I'm glad about that.
Just Tuesdays.
But I was single for 10 years. The first, I don't know, 5 or 6 of them, I never even thought about getting out or dating or anything because I was too busy. There was just too much going on to even think about that. And Once I did start dating, it was a few... I'm trying to figure out how to say this. Disaster piled upon disaster.
No, don't underspeak. You know? I really feel for people who date... When I say later in life, I don't mean on death's door, but I just mean not at 18, because that's stupid hard. Like, I mean, who knows what I'd do if something happened to Leslie, but the idea of dating sounds to me like the worst thing in the universe, you know?
Yeah. And I don't even know why I did. You know, that was the beginning of chat rooms, churchofchristsingles.com.
The happiest place on earth.
Which, just for the record, was the first disaster that I was involved in. People say and do things online that they wouldn't do.
Yes.
People being me too.
Yeah. People get brave on a keyboard and stupid.
Yep.
Inhibitions are lower. Mm-hmm. It's just not quite as real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, full disclosure... Or not full disclosure, because I'm not being totally transparent. I made a lot of bad decisions. But I have to look at that time in as the blessings that came out of it, too, in that I got out of a bubble of only one type of person that I knew. I saw what the world was like more. I'm not really saying what I'm trying to say here, but I definitely have a lot of empathy for people that are going in that time.
Yeah.
I struggled with some things. I made some good decisions, but ultimately I was able to say, okay, this is not working and I am fine. And I am, if God wants me to be married again, he is going to have to drop it in my lap.
Yeah.
And that's what he did.
Yeah, but it was Frank.
Yeah. But he really did.
Yeah.
Frank and I have known each other since we were at camp together. Mid-South Youth Camp. He's older than I am, and he was the athlete that dated all the cheerleaders, so we did not run in the same circles. 2 years made a lot of difference then. It doesn't make as much difference now.
It is my age. The difference it makes at 18 versus not 18.
Yeah. But, you know, his story, he married and had a career and then moved back to Henderson, and his wife developed cancer and died within about less than 2 years.
One thing that's interesting, and I'm not saying this right at all, you can go back to listen to Frank's story. He talks about losing his wife. Frank's story is a story of a cancer goes away, comes back, and you see where it's going, and you know where it's going to go, and it's fairly predictable, and it's public, and everyone knows. The story of the loss of your husband is a story of mental illness, private sin, and shame. These are my words, so if I speak wrong, don't blame Susan. Of mess. And you talked about how we've come a long way in dealing with mental health, and we have. We've got a long way to go, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think in 100 years, we're going to look back at what we're doing today in the same way that you and I look back at Civil War, like battlefield medicine.
Putting leeches on to heal you.
Yeah. And that's not insulting to, I just think we have that far to go still, and we don't know what we don't know. I support those. I'm grateful for where we are, and I'm anticipating getting better.
Yeah.
I say all that to say, grief is hard and complicated and painful when it is death, and that's the cleanest, easiest version of it.
Absolutely.
You went through a version where he moved out one Saturday, but your bubbles were small enough. If you went to dinner, you could see him in the restaurant. And as he continued to live his life, you would run into it, and he would have contact with your kids, and there are graduations and birthdays and grandkids, and I'm not spitting on him. You can if you want to. It's your job, not mine. But I just don't think people appreciate just how hard divorce is in terms of the grief and the weirdness of it.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a magic wand, I would require a divorce ceremony, same way you have a wedding.
Right.
Like, I think you know, is it Jewish people who like step on a wine glass at the beginning of a wedding? You know, I think maybe you'd like, well, I have a relative who peed on her marriage license. That gave her some closure.
I've thrown a few things.
But almost like there being a public step of this has ended. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a wake at a funeral. There's visitation.
Yeah.
But there's nothing. So people sit at home, and then people, your closest friends are there beside you. Those friends who aren't quite so close are talking about you and are sort of there, but they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. The acquaintances, and when you live in a bubble, and this is not a knock on Fried Hardeman, it's mm-hmm. just how it is.
A small town. I mean, it's just a small town.
Everybody knows, but nobody knows quite what to say to you because mm-hmm. they don't know the whole story, or they know parts of the story. It's just weird. Talk to me about that.
Well, the other thing that is part of that equation is that when your spouse dies, nobody blames you.
Yeah.
Nobody blames your spouse.
Unless you shot them.
Well, okay.
Just kidding.
That's why we didn't have guns in the house.
Kidding, not kidding.
But when there's a divorce, there's guilt and blame. And maybe I shouldn't have said blame. Maybe really the thing is guilt. What could I have done to have made this better? Should I have stayed? Should I have just sucked it up and kept trying, even after his affair? Quite honestly, when he had the affair, it was like, great. Now I've got an excuse.
Mm.
And that's sad.
Yeah.
That's very sad. I mean, we didn't immediately divorce. You know, we were together another 4 or 5 months. But, and you know, and we did some counseling. You know, we worked on it. But
every version of it, you feel what ifs.
Right.
Should I have tried harder and stayed longer? Is one moment. Then the next moment is, should I have gotten out earlier to save my kids from something?
Yeah. And that's the other, you know, huge thing that I'm still working through.
Yeah.
And this is where it's going to be hard.
It's okay.
Yeah. I probably felt the, should I have stayed? Should I have worked harder? At first, I mean, I did feel that. But now, where I am in my life and where my children are in their lives, they're grown, they're adults. But now my guilt is, why didn't I see what was going on? Why didn't I see how toxic it was and how much they were hurting?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't. I thought, well, we, you know, kept that together pretty well. We kept that from the kids pretty well, and we didn't have any knockdown, drag out fights that they saw. And thinking that, you know, you were holding it together for the sake of the children, I mean, that was the prevailing wind at the time.
Yeah.
You did that because, you know, every family needs two parents. They do. They need two healthy parents.
Which is worse, one parent or two that are in a toxic place.
So, as I have learned more and more about abuse, abusive behavior, and trauma, and how that has affected my children, And I do want to clarify that I meant abusive behavior. And I'm not going to go into that any deeper.
Yeah.
But trauma, for sure. And, you know, knowing that they carry, I think it's a thing. I know it may be sort of out of vogue now, but that there are some genetic predispositions to some mental illnesses. My kids have it on both sides of their family.
Yeah.
Both sides of the family. Obviously on their dad's side. And then, my family tree is filled with bipolar disorder, people with bipolar disorder.
I'd say our family tree has a lot of nuts on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's a joke, but there's truth.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think I was doing it in a prideful way, but I have often said, I'm the only one in my family not on psych meds.
Yeah.
And then what I've come to feel lately is like, and maybe I should have been.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I would have been a more pleasant person. Maybe, you know, I would have whatever. But, you know, I'm getting some therapy right now. I'm getting some counseling right now. And I have before, but not in a long time.
And this is working through stuff that happened 20 years ago, 30 years ago, more.
Yeah.
It's never too late to do some of that work.
Absolutely. But, you know, it doesn't end there.
No.
It's not just that. I mean, that's over. But, yeah, that's in my mind. You know, if somebody starts raising their voice at me and blaming me for something that I didn't do or I didn't intend that way, you think I go back in time to my first marriage when that happened and it would escalate? Yeah.
This stuff writes, well, you and I both have read recently, Body Keeps the Score, mm-hmm. I think. And the literal physical effect that traumas have on shaping us. One of the things that blew my mind in that book was how having adverse childhood experiences, fast forward 20 years, and the likelihood of you having autoimmune disorders,
mm-hmm.
or diabetes, or, you know, things that sort of feel like there's no connection between the pancreas,
mm-hmm.
and having someone in your house who yells at you. But evidently there is.
Yeah.
And trauma rewires the brain in a mm-hmm. huge way.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things, you know, I'm new to that study. I'm new to understanding these things. But it gives you a whole new outlook on a whole different outlook on kids that misbehave. Why are they misbehaving? Because they're selfish, spoiled brats that have never been disciplined? Maybe, but
sometimes.
But maybe they have had to develop coping mechanisms to be able to survive. And the only way, you know, that's whatever behavior I'm seeing.
Yeah.
Is part of their coping mechanism. And I don't know. I never took a psychology course in my life. I was all about the sciences and music, and I that was probably a big mistake. But
well, my confession is I took the CLEP test and guessed my way to psychology credit.
Well, I didn't CLEP psychology.
You know, just made up answers. Yeah, Freud, sure. You know.
Yeah, I CLEPed a lot of things too. Identified when you talked about that in your podcast because. I took the whole battery of CLEP tests too because didn't want to.
And faster.
Yeah.
And easier.
I know these English things. Why should I have to take a course in it? I want to do other things.
Exactly.
I took logic with Reuel Shelley and Christian evidences with Reuel Shelley. And, you know, I could because I had a lot of those electives out of the way.
I still remember being mad at my advisor at Freed. I guess it was Mark Blackwelder at the time because I think it was a second semester student begging to take one of the 400-level Bible classes because Jesse Robertson was teaching
mm-hmm.
it. and I knew he was going away to do grad school the next semester. And if I didn't have him, it was going to be somebody else. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be him because I heard he was the hardest and he was the best. And he wouldn't let me.
Well, I did the same thing with English Lit. My mom was an English teacher.
Yeah.
So she always taught a semester of English Lit and a semester of American Lit. And I wanted to take her because I knew she was the best teacher.
Yeah.
And so this year they made her take, she taught American the first semester. I'm like, okay, that's weird. So I took it. And then when the schedule came out, it's like, she's teaching American next semester too. She's not going to teach English Lit. Well, I'm not taking anybody else.
Yeah, I don't want these people.
So I crammed.
Yeah.
And it helped that I had a good English Lit teacher in high school.
Yeah.
A great, great teacher. And it also helped that I had graded my mother's test all those years. And so the names,
yeah,
the titles, and the authors were in my brain. And I'm good at multiple choice.
Yeah.
And so I clept out of American Lit, English, not because I know it, but because I'm a good test taker.
Yeah, I did English Lit as well.
Yep.
There was this great one, Analyzing and Interpreting Lit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically, could you read a paragraph and say what it was about? I'm like, how am I getting credit for this? Okay, we're probably off track here.
Yeah.
I only have another question or two for you.
Okay.
You can do whatever you want to do. I always tell people these shows are not like 900 numbers. They don't charge by the minute, so we can do whatever we want. But how would you say your faith has changed across your lifetime?
I don't remember a time when I questioned whether there was a God.
Yeah.
So that's been a constant. But how I grew up, in the conservative reaction from how the 40s and 50s were in church splits and things. And so I'm there in the 60s and 70s. And then, you know, it's very, we wouldn't have admitted it, but I think it was very works-based. Very much. We also wouldn't have admitted that we think we're the only ones going to heaven, but we got some serious questions about all you people that are worshiping with an instrument and only baptize people once a month and maybe don't take the Lord's Supper every week. And we did not do anything church-wise with any other church in our county.
Yep.
I mean, there were five or six different Churches of Christ in Chester County, but there were lots and lots of other churches. I'll take that back. We did do a volleyball league, a church-wide church league is what I'm trying to say. Because
Jesus
that
is not a volleyball.
Jesus is not there. Yeah, definitely in some of them. Some of those teams.
Teacher in high school who said, you think you're the only ones going to heaven? I don't think that at all. He said, who besides people who worship like you call the church the same thing you do, take communion like you do, organize like you do, baptize like you do, baptize when you do, and besides Jews in the Old Testament and babies and handicapped people, who do you think goes besides you? And I'm so grateful he had that conversation because he made me own the fact that I thought I was the only ones going.
Mm-hmm.
I would have denied it all day long until he proved to me that that is what I thought.
Yeah.
I'm so glad he did, because once I stared that in the face, all right, I either need to be honest about this or reevaluate. And I don't want to reevaluate just because I don't think it sounds good. I want to,
right?
You know, where's truth?
Yes. I think that my experience in Argentina definitely broadened my mind.
Mission work tends to do.
Yeah. It's like, we don't have to do things just exactly, excuse me, the way the American church does. And maybe these Catholics are closer to us than the devil worshipers.
Well, when you put it like that.
And I'm not saying everything's okay and there is no truth, but like a lot of people my age and who grew up the same way I did, there are way more gray areas now than there ever were when I was growing up. There are way fewer things that I think really matter.
Last year as a church, we talked about building bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to build walls, but bridges. Bridges. Bridges.
It takes effort. It takes being intentional.
And it takes security in, I'm okay. You know, I'm not worried that your sin's going to rub off on me. I'm not disgusted by you. I'm mm-hmm. secure. I'm okay. I know that God is not judging me on the basis of you. Without that stuff, you're never going to be able to do it.
Yeah. And we, you know, bridges, I'm preaching to the choir, but, you know, that implies relationships.
Mm-hmm. Connection.
And I know I have a reputation for being the one that says hello to everybody mm-hmm. in church, and that's on purpose.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily an outgoing person. I mean, people think I am, but I'm pretty happy just staying at home and reading a book or cleaning or going through stuff I've had. You know, not really cleaning. I don't know why I said that. Cleaning out is what I meant. Going through things that have been packed away I never got to.
Yeah.
Piddling.
Working on little projects.
Yeah. And not seeing anybody.
Yeah.
But I know, because I've been there, when everybody else has somebody to walk in with and sit by, and you don't, it's horrible. And so I want to show people that they matter and that they're noticed. And it's not hard.
No, it's a little scary the first times you do.
It is. But, you know, I say all the time, I know you've told me your name 5 times, and I am so sorry, but I just don't remember. And it's kind of like when you practice your Spanish on somebody, and you do a terrible job of, they don't care.
Yeah.
What matters is that you tried.
Hola, amiga.
Oh, me. But you know, it matters. It matters that I know their faces, even if I can't bring their name.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't do that if I didn't work at it, if I didn't get the directory and look at the pictures.
I do get real tired of how often I hear people at church say, well, I'm just bad at it. Everybody's bad at it. Do the work. The only way it gets easier is if you do it. And, I mean, I'm not good at names either. People think I am. I'm not. I make notes.
Mm-hmm.
I have stupid mental things. Hey, that's the guy who looks like a turtle. What's Turtle Dude's name again? Don't worry, he's dead. I can talk about Turtle Dude. You know, there's still people that if I don't see the two of them together, I can't remember which one's which, you know?
Yeah.
But
it's important, too. It is important. It is not important if I get to my seat on time.
Nope.
It is not important if I get my seat. Mm-hmm. It's not important if I sit by the people I usually sit by.
Yep. In fact, it's actually important that you don't.
It kind of is. But what is important is that I notice who has made an effort to come and be part of our family.
And it's not hard. Look, stand up. Look where there aren't people talking and go talk to the people who are awkwardly playing on the phone or have read the bulletin 7 times in a row so they don't have to make eye contact with people. There's your target. It's not hard.
Yep.
Well, it's been fun.
It has been fun.
You want to add anything else?
You always ask about favorite verses.
Yes.
So this will end.
Is it going to be so weird from Ezekiel?
Almost. No. I had a hard time figuring out.
Okay.
Got to put my glasses back on.
Sure.
But one of my go-to verses is Micah 6:8. And I realized this is my Bible that my mom gave me in, I figured out it was like 40 years ago.
Which looks real good. Are you sure you've been using it?
Well, you know, the last 10 years I haven't been using it too much. But if you look inside at all the places that are underlined, 1985, yep, cool. Almost 40 years ago.
Yeah, I was born in 84.
Has wrong name on it. Be quiet. Now I forgot what I was going to say.
No.
Oh, I had written inside two or three things, and one of them was Micah 6:8. He has shown you, oh man, which I have to change to y'all. He has shown y'all what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And that's good. That's what he says. It's good. Then I have I'm going to read the entire book of Ephesians. No, not really.
That's only like 20 minutes long, so.
Well, yeah, but we're probably out of time. But there again, as you can see, trying to pick out the passage in Ephesians was hard, but I'm going to read, I don't have it memorized. I don't memorize stuff.
That's okay.
Chapter 3, around 16 through 20, and I was going to do this from a more modern version, but I just love the NIV. It's just the language. It's the language of my heart. For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom his whole family in heaven and on earth derives its name. I pray that out of his glorious riches he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. And to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that's at work within us, to him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen.
I think that's how we end today.
I think so too.
Amen.
Amen.
See you next time.
All righty.
Thanks for listening to Rough Drafts. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. While you're at it, help us spread the word by leaving a rating and review. Until next time, let's keep looking for how God writes his love into our stories.